The headlines. Iran's top general warns about the repercussions of the growing military partnership between the U.S. and Israel in the Persian Gulf region. Syria condemns as a war crime the recent Israeli airstrikes on the Arab country's civilian infrastructure, saying that Tel Aviv must be held to account for the aggression. And Iran's top court rejects the demand by Cleric Muqtada al-Sadr to dissolve parliament as the deadlock over the formation of a new government continues. Thanks for joining us. Iran's top general warns of ramifications of the growing military partnership between the U.S. and the Israeli regime in the Persian Gulf region. Major General Mohammad Baghiri says the U.S. military has tried to make up for the withdrawal of its warships from the region by connecting the, quote, child killer Israeli military to the U.S. Central Command. He said the cooperation will provide the Israeli regime with America's spying facilities. The chairman of the chiefs of staff of the Iranian armed forces noted that the partnership will increase threats to Iran. Baghdadi, however, has warned regional countries hosting American and Israeli forces against any threat to Iran's security. He underlined that the Islamic Republic has always urged his neighbors not to rely on foreigners for regional security. Iranian Army's ground forces are holding two-day drills to increase their combat readiness in the face of new threats. Ehtedar, or Strength 1401, maneuvers have begun in the city of Nasrabad in the central province of Isfahan. The 2nd Brigadier General Amir Cheshak says the Army's infantry, armored, artillery, and electronic warfare divisions are participating in the drills. He says the different units will assess their coordination during hybrid operations and will show their creative indigenous tactics, among other skills. The military official also said the forces are trying to practice based on real-life world battles. He added the drills are both offensive and defensive in nature. The Albanian Prime Minister has announced severing diplomatic ties with Iran, citing an investigation into a recent cyber attack, which he blamed on Tehran.
The Council of Ministers has decided with immediate effect to end diplomatic relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. An official notice of this decision has been sent to the Embassy of the Islamic Republic, asking that all the diplomatic, technical, administrative, and security staff leave the territory of the Republic of Albania within 24 hours.
Edi Rama further said that his country's, quote, extreme response is fully proportionate to the gravity and the risk of the cyber attack. Iran has not reacted to the decision, but the relation between Tehran and Tirana has been tense since the Balkan nation provided safe havens to an anti-Iran terror group known as the MKO. Albania has been providing staunch support for the MKO, which has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilian since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The ill-famed group has also been delisted by the European Union and the United States from their terror lists. Earlier political analyst Osir Jazekci joined us to give his perspective on Albania's move to sever diplomatic ties with Iran. He says that Israel is to blame for Tirana's decision, which comes as Tel Aviv is seeking to derail the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal.
The latest and unexpected and a big scandal that happened today in Tirana, Albania, this event has probably been ordered, as always, by Israel, and most probably is related to the Iran nuclear deal. Whenever Israel wants to do some major attacks and provocation against Iran, but even the Americans, they use Albania. In 2018, many Mujahideen sources in Albania announced that MEK was planning to stage a fake terrorist attack in Albania in cooperation with Israel Mossad, and for this they were going to blame Iran, and they wanted to use this in order to give to Trump an excuse to attack Iran. But fortunately, the president and prime minister of Albania were put into notice about what Mossad and MEK was planning to do, and fortunately nothing happened.
Syria has slammed its recent airstrikes on civilian infrastructure, saying the regime's aggression against the Arab country amounts to a war crime. The statement by the Syrian Foreign Ministry said that Israel must be held to account for its deliberate and systematic attacks on civilian objects. Referred to two recent strikes on Aleppo International Airport that caused material damage and halted air services. Israel frequently carries out missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has time and again warned against the aggression and has lodged official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. Mohammed Ali is a correspondent joining us from Syria's capital, Damascus, to tell us more about what has occurred. Well, Mohammed, we're looking at a number of times now that airports in Syria are being targeted by Israel. What do you have for us on this?
Yes, this is the second time Israel attacks the same airport in just 1 week, Aleppo International Airport. However, this attack actually targeted directly the runways of airport. Now the airport of Aleppo is out of service as a result of this attack, and all flights were rescheduled to Damascus International Airport. Now, what happened was that last night, yesterday, at about 16 p.m. local time, Israel carried out this attack. Several missiles were launched from the direction of the Mediterranean, and they hit the international airport of Aleppo. Of course, also previously this year, Israel also attacked Damascus International Airport and caused damage to the runway. Directly, the attacks are targeting the runway because Israel wants those airports to go out of service, despite the fact that those are civilian airports. Now, the foreign ministry here in Damascus said that Israel's systematic attacks on civilian targets in Syria amounts to a crime of aggression and a war crime under international law, and that Israel must be held accountable, and that the Israeli occupation authorities are once again threatening peace, not just in Syria, but also in the region, security in general, of course. Now, also very important to note by the Foreign Ministry was that Syria will exercise its legitimate right to defend its land and people by all necessary means. Now, of course, we know that previously Syria sent tens of letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to shoulder responsibility in preserving international peace and security and stopping Israel from such attacks, but yet there has been no condemnation by the international community and no action.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mohammed Ali, a correspondent there from Damascus. Thank you. Moving on to Iraq, where the Supreme Court there has ruled out dissolving the country's federal government. That was a key demand of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr that sparked deadly unrest in recent weeks. In a statement, the court said it does not have the constitutional authority to suspend the assembly. It said the legislator must dissolve itself in case it is not carrying out its duties. The Supreme Judicial Council, Iraq's top judicial body, had also earlier expressed its inability to do so. The political turmoil gripped the Arab country after Sadr failed to form a government after winning most seats in the last election. Later, Sadr's supporters stormed parliament twice and launched a sit-in to demand the suspension of parliament and new elections. Last month, Sadr announced that he was quitting politics. That escalated the situation even further. Nearly two dozen people were killed before the cleric asked his supporters to end violence and evacuate the capital's green zone. Russian President Vladimir Putin warns of halting oil and gas supplies to countries that impose a price cap on Russian energy.
We will not supply anything at all if it is contrary to our interests, in this case economic interests. We will not supply gas, oil, coal or fuel oil. We will fulfill our contractual obligations in full.
Putin said that imposing a price cap on Russian oil and gas would be, quote, an absolutely stupid decision. He issued the warning at an economic forum in the far eastern city of Vladivostok. Hours after his remarks, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said that the bloc will propose a price cap on Russian gas. She said the move would lower the cost of gas and enable EU members to support the vulnerable households and companies. The proposal first came from the Group of Seven Developed Countries, or G7, is set to be discussed during an EU meeting on the energy crisis on Friday. but the bloc is split on the price cap plan. The Czech Republic is among the members that are against the move. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the West's provocative policies towards Moscow over the war in Ukraine are the reason that Russia has halted energy supplies to Europe.
I can say very clearly that I do not find the attitude of the West, no need to mention names, to be correct because it is a policy based on provocations.
Erdogan said that European nations should have considered how Moscow would respond to their support of Ukraine and the sanctions imposed on Russia. He added that everybody is now worried how they will survive this winter. Ankara has tried to stay neutral in the Ukrainian conflict, not joining the West in imposing sanctions on Russia. Erdogan has vowed to pursue a balancing policy. In July, Turkey hosted direct talks between the warring sides that yielded a deal on resuming Ukrainian grain exports that were halted after Russia's military campaign in Ukraine. Erdogan has also tried to arrange direct talks between Russia and Ukrainian presidents. The Turkish leader is expected to meet Putin at a regional summit in Uzbekistan next week. The newly appointed British Prime Minister, Liz Truss, faces grilling from the opposition Labour Party during the first session of Parliament after taking over the Tory leadership. Truss sparred with Labour leader Keir Starmer on the country's energy and cost of living crises. Truss said her cabinet will make sure that the new energy plan supports businesses and people. She pledged to use more domestic oil, gas, and nuclear energy to deal with the current crisis. The Premier said that her cabinet needs to address energy costs for businesses, adding that she is against imposing a windfall tax on energy companies to help tackle the price hike. Britain has been dealing with soaring gas prices and a subsequent inflation. Other European countries are also feeling the strain of record energy prices due to a halt in Russian gas supplies. Europe accuses Russia of using energy as a weapon, retaliation for Western sanctions. The Seoul Defense Dialogue discussed avenues of international cooperation as South Korea implements a hardline approach to Pyongyang. Frank Smith has more from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The Seoul Defense Dialogue Security Forum addressed the North Korea issue Wednesday as leading military strategists grappled for a coherent policy toward Pyongyang. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line involves strengthening the U.S. alliance and bolstering military capabilities, including a potential preemptive strike.
Kill chain will pre-detect North Korea's nuclear missile launch and be able to interfere with it, blocking any incoming nuclear attacks. And in order to prevent the worst case, we are intensively organizing the defense budget and developing military strategies to prepare a military retaliation.
President Yoon promised to normalize operations of the U.S. anti-ballistic missile system, THAAD, which was deployed in 2017, with new equipment brought in late Sunday night in an attempt to foil local protesters. Yoon has said he would like to deploy more THAAD missile batteries. At the forum, President Yoon's hard line was echoed by Japan.
There could be a lot of sanctions that would be imposed together with other countries, and there could be certain measures which some countries can do unilaterally, and it's a kind of a combination, but we have to share the same goal of urging North Korea to accept the terms. We have to figure out where it hurts most for the North Koreans.
Several forum speakers stressed coordinated sanctions, which have so far failed, yet offered few alternatives. Settling the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and ending sanctions against Pyongyang will require bringing North Korea to the negotiating table. But so far, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, appear unwilling to provide much incentive for North Korea to re-enter talks. Also on Wednesday, the nuclear envoys of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan met in Tokyo to coordinate strategies seeking to denuclearize North Korea. The U.S. repeated its offer to meet unconditionally with North Korea, while U.S.-led unilateral and U.N. Security Council sanctions remain in place. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has landed in a new controversy after accusing the government of plotting to appoint what he called a favorite as the next army chief. Pakistan's military has shot back at Imran Khan, calling his statements defamatory. Nasser Kazmi has more.
Pakistan's coalition government has shot back at former Prime Minister Imran Khan after he accused the government of delaying fresh elections to appoint a new military chief of its own choice to cover up what he called corruption in high places and high-profile officials' ill-gotten wealth. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif says those intending to hurt the bond between the armed forces and the people of country are not friends of Pakistan. Khan, who was deposed by a legislative no-confidence vote in April, has been staging massive rallies of his party supporters nationwide to press for early general elections, saying that his government was overthrown through a conspiracy hedged by the United States.
They want to bring in an army chief of their choice because they have stolen away money. They fear that if a strong, patriotic army chief is appointed, he will question them about their stolen wealth.
As per the law in country's constitution, Pakistan's prime minister has the authority to appoint new army chief. Pakistan's powerful military chief, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, is scheduled to complete his term in mid-November. The prime minister has to pick the new military head for the next 3 years from a list of generals submitted by the outgoing chief. While terming Khan's statement as unfortunate and disappointing, both the coalition government and the powerful military have denounced the charges labeled by the former prime minister. The government says that a long legal battle would be initiated against Imran Khan very soon.
The procedure of appointment of army chief is well defined in the constitution, and scandalizing the process is unfortunate. Imran Khan wants to destroy the country's economy and defense institutions. Our legal experts are examining it, and they will act accordingly.
While chairing a cabinet meeting to discuss a future strategy on Imran Khan's statements, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said those trying to draw a wedge between masses and armed forces of the country are not loyal to Pakistan.
Imran Khan is not the only political leader who has blamed military establishment for interfering in political matters. But given Khan's popularity, the military is not taking his criticism lightly. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
how Saudi Arabia tries to whitewash its crimes against humanity by the means of sports has been challenged. Recently, the kingdom's sports washing of war crimes in Yemen and domestic human rights abuses have been criticized by anti-war activists. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. The website of Truth Out wrote, peace activists recently challenged Saudi Arabia's sports washing of war crimes in Yemen and domestic human rights abuses by protesting outside and over a Massachusetts golf tournament funded by the repressive kingdom. Members of Massachusetts Peace Action and supporters rallied at the Bolton Fairgrounds in Lancaster, site of the shuttle bus to the LIV golf tournament at the International Golf Club in Bolton. The professional golf tour is financed by the Public Investment Fund, Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. Demonstrators held signs with messages including, Saudi money is blood money, and Saudi Arabia kills journalists and kids in Yemen, while an airplane circled over the event trailing a banner reading, Bolton rejects Saudi blood money. The Saudi bombing and blockade of Yemen has brought devastation to the people of that country. Paul Shannon, who chairs Massachusetts Peace Action's Middle East Working Group, said in a statement. He added, that destruction has been enabled by our country's support for the Saudi invasion and by bombs, planes, and missiles sold to the Saudis by U.S. military contractors like Lockheed, Boeing, and Raytheon. Protester Ali Sereni of Bolton told WCVB, I'm outraged that it's my town that's hosting a golf tournament that's funded by the terrorist and murderous regime in Saudi Arabia. Another demonstrator, Paul Carver, asserted that golf should not be used to promote a government like Saudi Arabia that is doing these things in the world to people. He added, we do not condone collaboration with a murderous dictator like the Crown Prince. In addition to peace activists, relatives of people killed in September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States, which were possibly backed by some Saudi officials, have called out LIV golfers as well as former President Donald Trump for hosting LIV event at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey. While campaigning in 2016, Trump blamed Saudi Arabia for 9/11. However, once elected, he behaved like every U.S. president by maintaining friendly relations with the oil-rich kingdom's rulers and selling them hundreds of millions of dollars in arms for use in the U.S.-backed coalition war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people while displacing, starving, and sickening millions more. At the recent protest, Massachusetts Peace Action also handed out pamphlets thanking the professional golfers who have eschewed the tournament so as not to be associated with an event created with millions of dollars from one of the most repressive regimes on the face of the earth. Also, the website of Nation wrote, Is the Kingdom of Gulf being used to sport wash the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? Or is it the other way around? After all, what other major sport could use a sandstorm of Middle Eastern murder and human rights abuses to obscure its own history of bigotry and greed? In fact, not since the 1936 Berlin Olympics was used to cosmeticize Nazi Germany's atrocities and promote Aryan superiority have sports and an otherwise despised government collaborated so blatantly to enhance their joint international standings. Golf symbolized reactionary greed even before the Saudis entered the picture. For starters, its competitors are among the only professional athletes ranked purely by the cash prizes they have won, and the leading golfers invariably earn far more from endorsements and speaking engagements. Golf has long been retrograde, exclusionary, and money-obsessed. To put that in perspective, the estimated revenue of the Professional Golf Association in 2019 was $1.5 billion, and it boasts a non-profit status that's sometimes been questioned. Lucrative as it is, it also proved distinctly vulnerable to an attack by an oil-soaked autocracy that, in warming up to invade golf, had already invested in Formula One racing, esports, wrestling, and its most recent controversial purchase, a British Premier League soccer team, which provoked protests from fans and Amnesty International. Still, the Saudis' move on golf has even bolder, more ambitious, and somehow almost ordained to happen. Unlike football and baseball, which are convenient amalgams of socialism for the owners in their collusive cooperation and dog-eat-dog capitalism for the players and other personnel, golf is a more of a monarchy along the lines of Saudi Arabia.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is the minbar you are listening to. May Allah accept your mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Today we invite you to listen to an English lecture by Brother Amin Rastani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. What we want to do tonight, inshallah, some of the verses of the Quran that the Imams, or not Imams, but Imam Hussein in particular, would use to answer people. So that we get this idea of, oh, this was a culture with the Imams, and even with our scholars, till today, that they will inject, whenever they can, and wherever in their speech they can, they will inject verses of the Quran. Alright, it's pretty cool. You all know that kid that had memorized the Quran back then, Alamul Huda, right? You've heard of him? That little kid, remember, he was really famous like 20 years ago? No? Those of you who are saying no, it's because you're like only 20 years old yourselves. But 20, 25 years ago, there was a little kid, Sayyid Alam al-Huda, his name was Muhammad Hussein Alam al-Huda. That really, like, he was the talk of that time. Everyone was speaking about this kid who had memorized the Quran completely, Nahj al-Balagha, everything. And his father's a scholar, and he was in Qum. I think the older brothers and sisters remember that kid. Well, he's not no kid anymore. He's like a proper scholar himself now, by the way. We used to teach him English back in Qum, by the way. So, anyway, this kid, when you would speak to him, when he would answer you, right, he would drop verses of the Quran left and right, relevant to the discussion. It was I actually tested him once or twice. And yeah, It had just become part of him. Isn't that beautiful? So the imams also, you find this, whenever they get the chance, they are dropping verses of Quran, even in their normal speech, right? So I want to give us a few examples of that with Imam Hussein when he's answering people with Quran. And then I want to move on to some of the verses that Imam Hussein on that journey from Medina to Karbala, he recited as well. What those occasions were, why he used those verses. It just gives validity to whatever you're doing. It gives a nice touch of spirituality to whatever you're doing, especially if it's something great like what Imam Hussein did. So we have here a few verses that I want to share with you in this regard as well. It says that when Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he was leaving Medina, after he sees no choice but to leave the city of Medina because they're going to take his life or apprehend him, as he is leaving, he recites Surah Qasas verse 21, which kind of shows that he is starting his whole trip because he has no choice. There is a fear. So as he's leaving, he recites this verse. It's very famous. And it breaks your heart that he's reciting this while he's leaving the city of his own grandfather. This is where we were honored by Allah, by the people. It says, فَخَرَجَ مِنْهَا خَائِفًا يَتَرَقَّبْ قَالَ رَبِّ نَجِّنِي مِنَ الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. This small verse says it all. That he recites the verse that has to do with Prophet Musa when he had to leave Misr, his hometown. He had to leave Egypt. Why? Because he was in trouble. Musa got in trouble because of that little scuffle he got in with that enemy of the Bani Israel. One of those people of Fir'aun. And he killed him accidentally. And now Fir'aun is in trouble. Musa is in trouble. And so as he's leaving, he has no choice but to leave the city. The Quran says, Musa left the city khaifan, while being fearful. Khaifan, yataraqab. Kind of, if I use layman's terms here, yataraqab means looking over his shoulder, expecting something bad to happen all the time. And as he's leaving, he says, Ya Allah, O Allah, najjini min al-qawm al-zalimeen. Save me from the zalimeen. So this little verse, which is what the Imam starts his journey with. By the way, he starts his journey with Quran and his journey ends with Quran on the spears. He begins his journey with this, letting the people know dhulm and oppression is happening. Something that is not supposed to be happening to me. I have no choice. I'm asking Allah to save me to the point that I have fear. I fear for my life. Don't think that I was a troublemaker. I was after this. I was after that. I was after fame. No. I am leaving because I fear for my life. Now later on, the Kufans write him letters and he sees that, okay, there's a good opportunity, all of that. Things developed. But in the beginning, as he's leaving, this is the verse he recites. And then, as he is entering Mecca, the sanctuary of Islam, the sanctuary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he recites the next verse of Surah Qasas. Qasas 22. What does that verse say? فَلَمَّا تَوَجَّهَ تِلْقَاءَ مَدْيَنَ. So when Prophet Musa left, he went towards the city of Madian. Who was living in Madian? Which Prophet of Allah? Somebody tell me. Huh? Shu'aib. Yes, alayhi salam. So he's going to Madian, Prophet Musa. So the Quran says, when he turned towards Madian and is slowly going towards Madian, قَالَ عَسَى رَبِّي أَن يَهْدِيَنِي سَوَاءَ السَّبِيلِ. That, okay, there's hope that Allah is going to show me what I'm supposed to do. The right path. Sawa as-sabil. Here, when the Holy Imam enters Mecca or is moving towards Mecca, he recites this verse. فَلَمَّا تَوَجَّهَ تِلْقَاءَ مَدْيَنْ قَالَ عَصَرَ. So some might take this verse to show and use it as proof that Imam Hussein, not from the beginning, wanted to overthrow and all of that. Yes, he was doing the right thing, which is not to give his bay'ah. And doing his amr bil ma'roof through not giving his bay'ah. And as things went forward and unfolded, he said, okay, now's the time to do this. Now's the time to do that. Muslim, you go to Kufa. Let's see what's going on there. The letters came back and so on and so forth. Now, there is a whole discussion. If Imam Hussein knew how bad the Kufans are, why'd he go? There is a whole nice talk about that. I don't know when we'll get to that, inshallah, one day. But there are good things to be said here as well, in my opinion. But he uses this verse. He could have just said something else. But you see, the Quran, and using the Quran, they say in Arabic, is awqa' fin nafs. That means it sits in the heart even better. Yes? So the Imam, he's letting the people know, but through the verses of the Quran, what's going on. On the day of Ashura, it says that when the Imam, alayhi salam, when he saw خطب بها لما رأى صفوف أهل الكوفة بكربلاء, when he looked and he saw these rows of enemies in the plains of Karbala waiting to kill him, he delivered a talk, a sermon to them. What did he say? He said, نِعْمَ الرَّبُّ رَبُّنَا, our Lord is such a good Lord. وَبِئْسَ الْعِبَادُ أَنْتُمْ, and you are such bad servants of Allah. أَقْرَرْتُمْ بِالطَّاعَةِ وَآمَنْتُمْ بِالرَّسُولِ, you pronounced your submission. You accepted the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. ثُمَّ إِنَّكُمْ رَجَعْتُمْ إِلَىٰ ذُرِّيَّتِهِ وَعِتْرَتِهِ تُرِيدُونَ قَتْلَهُمْ, but then you turned around pursuing the qatl and killing of the progeny of this prophet that you embrace. How bad, how ungrateful can you be? But you see, if you keep saying these things, it's one thing, but you got to top it off with the verse of the Quran. And so he says, لَقَدْ اسْتَحْوَذَ عَلَيْكُمُ الشَّيْطَانُ فَأَنْسَاكُمْ ذِكْرَ اللَّهِ الْعَظِيمِ. He cites Surah Mujadala, verse 19. He says, you know what? Shaytan has overcome you. Shaytan is sitting in your hearts. فَأَنْسَاكُمْ ذِكْرَ اللَّهِ. As a result, what happens? When you let Shaytan in to the heart, you can be sure Allah's not going to be in that heart anymore. اسْتَحْوَذَ عَلَيْكُمُ الشَّيْطَانُ. He applies a verse of the Quran to these people, to these monsters. And so maybe through using verses of the Quran, he can get to the parts of these people. Of course, their hearts are stone. فَتَبَّلْ لَكُمْ وَلِمَا تُرِيدُونَ. He curses what they're after. إِنَّا لِلَّهُ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. And so on, he says.
Swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
In recent years, the United States administration has imposed a series of measures and sanctions against Chinese technology companies as part of a strategy to curb or delay China's emergence as the world's new technology hub. According to a new study by the China Development Institute, from January of 2017, when the Trump administration took office, to June of 2021, when the Biden administration passed the United States Innovation and Competition Act, the U.S. Congress published 209 analytical reports on China's science and technology policies. These policies include sanctions on Chinese high-tech companies, regulations and restrictions on advanced technologies for teaching science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In this way, Huawei, as one of the most prominent manufacturers of Chinese communications equipment, bore a heavy burden, because one of the biggest goals of the United States sanctions has been to affect technology competition through the application of trade policies. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of world media for further details. The Asia Times has published many analytical articles about this story and elaborated more about US's wrong sanction policies against independent countries such as China as a new world power in the field of high-tech advancement. In an article published on 2nd of September, the Asia Times wrote, "In another step aimed at stifling China's technological advance, the U.S. Department of Commerce has decided to restrict shipments of advanced graphics processing units, or GPUs, designed by American companies, NVIDIA and AMD, to China. The U.S. government claims it is worried about potential military applications of these products. GPUs, or graphics processing units, are a type of integrated circuit used in graphics and video image generation, high-performance computing, and the acceleration of artificial intelligence and machine learning. NVIDIA and AMD, both based in California, are the 9th and 10th largest semiconductor companies in the world, as ranked by revenue in 2021. The stock prices of both companies dropped under sanctions news, NVIDIA's precipitously. After falling 12% intraday, NVIDIA's shares closed down 7.7% on 1st of September. AMD shares closed down 3%. Both stocks fell further in after-hours trading. However, looking ahead, these numbers make it clear that the semiconductor industry can no longer plan on selling its newest and most advanced products in China. Companies' growth prospects and return on investment may be reduced, and their share prices may thus test new lows. On 12th of August, the U.S. Commerce Department announced restrictions on exports of electronic design automation, or EDA, tools to China. This prompted Handel Jones, Chief Executive Officer of electronics industry consulting firm International Business Strategies, to write that such restrictions might have catastrophic impact worldwide, resulting in major disruptions of the global electronics industry. According to a recent report by Bloomberg News, under former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. began extensive deployment of export controls in an effort to cut off Chinese technology champions, including Huawei Technologies, from key sophisticated equipment and software. President Joe Biden continued that effort and even expanded it. Given China's manufacturing prowess, as well as its prodigious and growing ranks of engineers, this delay strategy was bound to fail without something more. Just recently, evidence emerged that China's Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation had likely advanced its production technology by two generations, despite U.S. sanctions. But the U.S. has now put some offense on the field, with President Biden recently signing the so-called Chips and Science Act, aimed at strengthening the American semiconductor industry. But for the U.S. and its desire to stay ahead of a fast-advancing China, would it be enough? J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. estimates U.S.-made chip production slid from 37% of the market in 1990 to just 12% of the market last year. U.S. officials claim that may eventually change as Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo moves to deploy $52.7 billion for research, development, manufacturing, and workforce development. The New York Times explains more about the issue, saying, "The Biden administration has imposed new restrictions on sales of some sophisticated computer chips to both China and Russia, the U.S. government's latest attempt to use semiconductors as a tool to hobble rivals at advances in fields such as high-performance computing and artificial intelligence. The new limits affect high-end models of chips known as graphics processing units, or GPUs, which are sold by the Silicon Valley companies NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices AMD. Such products were originally developed to render images in video games, but in the past decade were widely deployed in the largest supercomputers used by scientists and by internet companies for applications such as recognizing speech and objects in photographs. Supercomputers are used in applications that include weapons development and intelligence gathering. Artificial intelligence technology is also increasingly being used for purposes such as identifying faces in video images. The restrictions are part of a Cold War between China and the United States for primacy in advanced technologies. The Biden administration, building on limits begun under former President Donald J. Trump, has adopted measures aimed at restricting access by companies such as China's Huawei, to advance chips and foreign semiconductor manufacturing. Moreover, a recent report by Japan's Science and Technology Ministry shows China has overtaken the United States as the world leader in both scientific research output and high-impact studies. According to the report published by Japan's National Institute of Science and Technology Policy, China now publishes the largest number of scientific research papers yearly, followed by the United States and Germany. The report said China published a yearly average of 407,181 scientific papers, pulling ahead of the United States' 293,434 journal articles and accounting for 23.4% of the world's research output. China also accounted for a high proportion of research into materials science, in chemistry, engineering, and mathematics. The figures are based on yearly averages between 2018 and 2020. Shinichi Kuroki of the Japan Science and Technology Agency told Nikkei Asia that China is one of the top countries in the world in terms of both the quantity and the quality of scientific papers that it publishes. Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden signed the CHIPS and Science Act, legislation that would authorize more than $200 billion in research funding over 10 years to make U.S. scientific research more competitive with China. U.S. lawmakers passed the $280 billion CHIPS and Science Act out of fear that China was about to overtake the United States in scientific and technological expertise. But the recently released study suggests China was already beating the United States in this field. Chinese President Xi Jinping has prioritized investments in research and development in an effort to make China more self-sufficient. The country spent a record $441.3 billion on research and development in 2021.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseinia on July 27, 2022.
There are many concepts of the revolution that we once proclaimed, followed, and are still following to this day. The Friday prayer leader should be able to convey these great concepts in today's language and in the language of the younger generation. Issues such as the issue of justice, the issue of independence, the issue of helping the poor, the issue of following religious laws, and matters that are among the principles and foundations of the revolution. You are the spokesman of the revolution. Sermons should be meaningful and enlightening. They should answer the people's main questions. There are questions that you can answer in your sermons without even mentioning the question. You can answer the questions that are in people's minds with your sermons. The language used in sermons should be sincere, friendly, unifying, and promising. Your sermons should be promising. Every word you say in your sermons can be an example of the verse, "He it is who sent down tranquility into the hearts of the believers, that they may have more faith added to their faith." The Quran, Surah 48, verse number 4.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, it is also possible your sermons become a cause of anxiety and concern. Concern is not always a bad thing, but your words may cause worry, fear, or hopelessness. The way you speak can lead to both of these feelings. Sermons should be promising and insightful. They may sometimes have other effects. You may say things that the enemies can use as an excuse to say things against you. One of the things our sermons need to do is to confront the continuous doubts and rumors that our enemies are spreading. As I said, the battlefield we are in today is a soft war battlefield, and the enemy's soft weapon is instilling doubts. What does instilling doubts mean? We have a nation of people who have stood up for this revolution with complete faith and belief. They've sacrificed their lives. They have strived, endeavored, and led this revolution to success. Our people defended our country for 8 years during the imposed war, and then against the constant seditions of the enemies. They have been present whenever they were needed. This is the kind of people we have. Now, if our enemies want to destroy this strong fortress or cause it any harm, what should they do? They have to attack the people's faith. They have to cause controversies regarding their beliefs.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.